When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Hey out there, rock and rollers. Welcome to the 48th edition of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast, recorded right here in central London, just off historic Abbey Road. And I want to thank everybody who tuned into episode number 47 on Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. We know we don't do a lot of soul music on this show. It's mostly rock and roll, classic rock, prog rock, early MTV, heavy metal, stuff that we loved growing up, but that was a classic record. And as we're marching towards our 50th show, we wanted to celebrate some of the truly great records that are celebrating their 50th anniversary this year, and you couldn't keep Marvin Gaye's What's Going On off that list. Now, in addition to doing another incredible record celebrating its 50th anniversary this year in Who's Next, we're going to start off the show with a live performance by Iron Maiden lead singer Bruce Dickinson. Bruce is an incredible guy, a true polymath who could do all sorts of incredible things like be a commercial airline pilot and own an aviation company, not to mention writing and singing amazing songs for Iron Maiden and as a solo artist for 40 years, writing fiction and nonfiction, being a TV presenter, being a master beer brewer. He's a really incredible guy, and he embarked on a tour of the UK here recently, which had to be postponed. I was supposed to see him in August. He contracted COVID. He did recover, thankfully, and he just was able to perform those dates here recently. Got to see him at Shepherd's Bush O2. And we're going to talk a little bit about that first before we get into Who's Next. As far as the Who goes, yes, I have had the opportunity to see the Who a few times. Was supposed to see them again last year, and it just didn't happen. COVID canceled that show. They postponed it to this year, but then when they realized they're going to have to postpone it again, they decided to go ahead and cancel out that show, which was too bad because their last album titled The Who was amazing. It's their best album in more than 40 years. I was really psyched to hear a lot of that live, but unfortunately that didn't happen. We'll see if it happens in the near future. But as far as Who's Next go, it's really one of the true great classic records of all time. Culled from ideas from a third rock opera between Tommy and Quadrophenia that was supposed to be called Lifehouse. It really kind of takes the best of what they were working on towards that didn't end up really coming to life. Now, Pete Townsend did kind of breathe life into it much later in his career in the 90s. I think they did finally record some of that live and bring it all together into what was kind of his original vision. So he kind of worked on that for really more than 30 years, but got together with Glyn Johns in 1971 and decided, okay, well, let's take what we have, what's the best of what was supposed to be this Lifehouse project, and let's put it into an album, right? And of course, they had the iconic cover of them urinating against the big obelisk, which could have been reminiscent of 2001 Space Odyssey, big black obelisk, but was instead kind of post-industrial wasteland. And of course, the song Baba O'Reilly with the lyrics Teenage Wasteland open up that record. So it's really a true classic. And as we march towards our 50th show, we wanted to pay homage and tribute to this extraordinary statement by The Who, one of the true greatest rock bands of all time. Now, before we get into the show, just a little housekeeping. Remind you, you can tweet us at @ugly_werewolf and at @ActionJack72 DMS. Let us know what's going on with you and which songs, which albums, which bands, which concerts you would like us to review. And you can check out all past episodes at www.uglyamericanwerewolf.libsyn.com. Of course, you can download and subscribe most anywhere you get your podcast. And we would appreciate if you like the show, give us a positive review. It helps us find more listeners like you and will help us get more fun interviews down the road in the future. So with that, hey, let's jump into it. It was a great night out at Shepherd's Bush Empire with Bruce Dickinson. A lot of fun. He's an amazing entertainer, and I was really fortunate to be able to see him. Glad he's healthy and doing his thing again. And then we'll get into the who's next, right here on The Wolf.
Pantheon Podcast listeners, Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
So what's happening back in the United States of America? Jackson, anything good?
Oh, we're just trying to get ready for the big fall spectaculars here. Weather's getting cooler, which is nice because it's really hot here in South Georgia.
Yes.
We had some friends come over last night and they said, oh yeah, by the way, there's probably like a 6-foot rattlesnake down the street. So we went to go see that. It's the biggest snake I've ever seen, not in a zoo. And it was just crawling through the grass on the empty lot about four houses down. And I said, I'm never coming out of my house again. I will never leave my home.
What'd you get for living in a swamp, man?
Yeah, clearly. Yikes.
Yeah.
Had a big old belly full of something, ate a squirrel, or I don't know what it was, but no thanks.
We have more like pigeons and rats in London. It's not quite as tropical here, although it's temperate. Here's the thing. I think the weather in London, when it's not raining, is actually pretty nice. It doesn't get super hot in the summer. It's kind of like a nice spring for the most part.
Yeah. I would agree with you. I think people would complain that it was cold, but if you actually lived where it was cold, it wouldn't be that bad.
Yeah, compared to Maine, which is a lot further south than London, it seems. So yeah, it's a lot warmer. I guess that's about stuff I don't really understand. You know, jet streams and...
Now, you're talking about rats in London?
Yeah.
Like, are they like the big, like, New York City rats or...
Well, I've only seen a few, and rats are so much bigger than mice. Squirrel-sized rats. Don't see many squirrels, but... I have seen some.
Now you know why.
What do you want to do first?
Let's do the show first.
Do the show first.
Yeah, because that was just last night, so.
Yeah, it was nice. It was nice to be out again, and it was not a huge place. I mean, I think it said it listed as 2,000, but once again, the tiers are separated, and there's not much movement in between. I was on the floors in the sixth row. So it was actually pretty close. It may have been the closest I'd ever been to Bruce Dickinson. And how many times have I seen him? Six times, maybe? Seven? I can't even remember. But anyway, yeah, a place called Shepherd's Bush Empire, which, interestingly enough, has a tie-in to The Who from back in the day, which will factor in later. And the Rolling Stones did a cool show there. You know, back when they did their, I think it was maybe 40 Licks, when they did three shows in a town, like they do a theater, and an arena and a stadium in some places.
Yeah.
In London, I think Shepherd's Bush was the theater that they chose to do.
Okay.
And then I assume they did like O2 in Wembley or something like that. But at any rate, so this is a classic old place. It's over 100 years old. Once again, the chairs were awfully small. And once again, for whatever reason, there was not anyone sitting directly next to me. So I could stick my feet. I'd kind of spill over into that chair, which is good because there's a stinky kid next to me trying to spill all over into me from the other side. I'm like, ugh, get away, you booger.
So this was Bruce Dickinson's speaking tour, correct?
Well, yeah, I was supposed to see him in August, and he got COVID. I mean, it was literally that night, or it was maybe the night before, that, you know, I was like getting all ready, and I bought this Trooper beer, which wasn't hard to, it wasn't easy to find, and I tracked some down, like, this would be great. I'd just go out, watch Bruce do his thing, and then he got COVID, and obviously it was canceled. It was only about 2 months, and yeah, it's him kind of talking about his life and growing up and how it came to be. Of course, he has a certain flair for entertainment, you know, and has an incredible voice, whether it be speaking or acting or singing or doing impersonations. He did a great Nico McBrain. It was fantastic. And so it was fun, you know, and I felt like it did start maybe a little slow. I'm like, the first 15 minutes, there weren't the ribald laughs. There were a couple of, you know, chuckles here and there. But being the consummate entertainment professional that he was, he just kept on, kept his energy up. And you know, he didn't just say, and then I went in Iron Man and then this. He kind of took broad stroke things, and he didn't get too bogged down in the details and things like that. Didn't really get too much into his private life, at least not wife and kids' private life. A little bit from growing up with his parents and going to school and stuff like that was kind of seemed to be a big chunk of the first part of it. But it was cool. You know, he's basically doing a one-man show. And I could tell that his voice was good. Talking about everything, how he got into piloting basically because Nico could do it. He's like, well, if a drummer can do it, how hard could it be? So that honestly, Nico had to come save him one day with a place like, well, look, if Nico could do it, geez, how could it be so tough? So it was a fun night just to kind of hear him out and about. And then after he got done, he did more than an hour and a half of shtick and story and stuff. You know, had a big screen behind him with a clicker, basically like a PowerPoint thing almost, that he would just click through and show different pictures along the way. Poked, you know, took the piss out of himself, poked fun at himself, you know, for the mustaches that he had over the years, whether it was in Samson or, you know, when he had cancer and throat cancer, then eventually that fell out. Or it's like, you know, over the years, these horrible mustaches, you know, these unfortunate mustaches would creep up. And just a funny guy, and made fun of his pants, you know, and of course he showed the lizard costume from the Somewhere in Time tour.
Seemed like a good idea.
Yeah. Right, you know, and he had this designer, look, if we went to an alien civilization and it was populated with lizard people, and I was wearing some kind of jumpsuit, make it look like that, you know. It was funny. It was nice. And it was a good spot. And he did that for an hour and a half, maybe a little more. There's an intermission. Go back, and there's kind of a bar elevated back there. Again, the ground floor wasn't that big. I mean, it must be like 700, 600, 600 on the three different levels or whatever. And just like the Palladium where I saw Steve Hackett last month, it was tiered off. The riffraff from the upstairs could not come down to mingle downstairs. I think that goes back to the very class society that it was over 100 years ago here in England. Yeah, I don't want people like you and me who might just get the upper deck seats to have to be endured by, you know, the hoi polloi.
The upper crust.
Downstairs are betters, you know, so. but it was nice. So back there was some good space back there. It kind of reminded me of a place called Bogart's near Cincinnati, where I've seen the Cult a couple of times, except there's no seats there. It's all kind of gen ed. You just kind of make your way up. But other than that, yeah, there's a big bar in the back. And then, I don't know, because I didn't want that kid laying all over me and farting on me, you know, the whole time, I decided to stay back by the bar, and they let me. And there was a little ledge kind of like past the bar where you can look over the crowd. There's nobody in front of me. And I'm like 10 feet tall. I'm a head taller than Bruce on the stage. And then to my left down below was the rig. You know, it had all the board, the video board, sound board, mixing, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And there's three or four people down there. I was looking for Rod Smallwood because he said Rod was here someplace. So I want to keep my eye on it, but he wasn't there. And so I sat up there. And then after he did some questions from the audience, you know, they had little cards they gave you. I didn't turn mine in because they didn't have tickets to this event. It was just an on your phone, click the thing. So I'm like, that's my ticket. I'll keep that. Because either A, he's not going to read my question, or B, I'm always suspect. I've seen this before. I'm sure some of the questions are directly from the audience. I just have a feeling some they set up every night.
Reminds me of a great question. A great story that I'm going to tell you. Did somebody really ask you that? Okay.
Well, I don't know. I learned a lot of Nico stuff in the flying story in the encore, because they did some cool ones, like, you know, which band would you be in if you couldn't be in, you know, any other band or whatever. And he's like, I don't know what. And of course, shouts are coming out from everywhere. He said, you know, believe it or not, I did, once Ronnie James Dio left, I did kind of get the call for Rainbow.
Huh. Okay. They're
like, would you be interested? And he's like, yeah, I would be. And it ended up going to Graham Bonnet in his Hawaiian shirt, you know, instead. But, or no, he, you know, obviously things worked out for him for the Iron Maiden. But the question was, who's the most famous person you see naked? And he said, Nico McBrain. And then he went into the 15-minute monologue on Nico. And like, you know. and it was hilarious. I mean, the dub drummers are different animals because he used to be a drummer, and then Thunderstick was in Samson, and so he'd just be the singer and not the drummer, or not, you know, not play bongos or whatever. I don't know. It was great tales of his life. It was fun, but yeah, the whole Nico thing, because at that point he kind of put his cards down and he went through all this 15-minute story that had different acts in it and different motions, and it just said, yeah, it looks like he might have thought through some of that before, or maybe he's just waiting in the encore, or, you know, at some point, a question he can just say Nico McBrain for something like, who's the most famous person you see naked? This is a great time to do the Nico McBrain story or whatever, right?
Okay, so the story was going to happen regardless of what the question was. He was going to ram it into.
All the members in Iron Maiden, who's the most whatever? Well, that's Nico McBrain, you know?
So, speaking of that, let me tell you this story.
No, so that was fun. And I didn't get my ears blown out, but I still got to be entertained by this great entertainer. He did a bit of singing, a cappella, just once in a while. Just, you know how it goes, you know, it's like, or whatever. I'm like, wow, you know, he just gave us a little glimpse of it, and it still sounded nice, rich, smooth, no cracks in it. I mean, I know that he can still do it, because I was thinking about this last night. I mean, in relative comparison to most of our rock heroes, Jackson, these days, he's relatively young in his early 60s, right? In his early 60s, one of the relatively young rock stars who we still are trying to go see while they can and we can, right?
Correct. Yeah, that's why I texted you. I said, when this tour gets back underway, I don't know what it's going to be, because they got the new record. They were doing the Legacy of the Beast tour. But whatever it is, we need to figure it out and get to it.
Yeah, I think I have a ticket somewhere in the Netherlands for next year, because I bought it last year. Obviously, it didn't happen. Got pushed to this year, and they said, nope, going to do it next year. But they are doing like the Download Festival, I feel like. I think Kiss is maybe doing one night as well. So that's an opportunity, maybe. Yeah, I mean, they got to do it. I'm sure they'll make some writing on the wall. And that was cool. After he got done with his hour and a half or whatever, they played the Writing on the Wall video with the sound effects and the music.
Oh, cool.
This is funny. It was great to see it up there, but I was up pretty close. And I swear, once he came off, they ran Writing the Wall. I don't think his mic was off. And I don't know if it was off his head sitting near him, but it wasn't off. And I could hear a little bit of chatter with him, and then I'm like, I think I hear somebody else. I'm like, so it might not even be on him. But it's like, I hear a little bit of this guy's like, do you guys not hear that? I thought it was kind of funny. Nothing crazy, and I couldn't really necessarily make out everything they were saying. But I just thought that was an interesting little tidbit.
Oh, like he didn't view it. Okay, I was waiting for you to say, like, oh, these guys are tool bags. No. You know, like, oh, what a jerk he really is.
No,
and
so unfortunately, nothing.
Did he talk about the new record? Like, about how, like, they basically made it in secret? Nobody knew what was going on until they dropped it?
No, you know what? It was not like, you know, Iron Maiden did this album, I did this. It was more like just kind of broad strokes. You know, I ended up getting the Maiden gig for one reason or another. He talked about going to Poland after the World Slavery Tour just about killed him, and he had to come back into a decent frame of mind again. But he didn't be like, oh, we hit this success and then did this and did that. And he talked about like going to, in the early 80s, going to Rio, going to South America was huge for him and huge for the band. And told a story about how he kicked the monitors off the stage one evening because they just sucked or whatever. It was true. He didn't, you know, it wasn't like a chronological, this was my, well, it did go in chronological order, but it wasn't like all the bullet points. He didn't go through all records or anything like that. It's just kind of things that happened. Going to South America was big. It wasn't, we made this record and hit the chart. None of that. We went behind the Iron Curtain before the Berlin Wall fell and, you know, doing things like that. And then, you know, I did solo stuff. The cancer thing was obviously a pretty big part of it. But he didn't even really get back to you. I left Maiden and came back into Maiden. That didn't even come up. And so I don't think there was any song, really, that he described the recording of. Except for generally when he's talking about how, Nico, when you do the middle eight, what's that part then? Well, it's one part fly on your way like any... He goes, oh, you mean the part that goes... You know, he's like, yes, that part there. Can you slow that down a bit? Whoa, you mean not ply? You know, so he... But he wouldn't talk about, you know, we recorded this and all that kind of stuff. It was... It was more just a story of his life and how some things came back together and how he flew to Africa for, because he's a pilot and he's logged like 8,000 hours, you know, as a commercial airline pilot. He's flown all over the world. He's flown a lot to Africa, and he found out like his uncle, who was a good dear friend to him growing up when he was in the RAF, he used to fly planes at the exact same landing strip, you know, back during World War II or whatever. And, you know, how things, yeah, it was cool. It was, you know, things come back around and stuff, and talk about how being sick with COVID was hard. You know, it was, but he got over it. It was a fun night out, and he's energetic. You know, he's smart. He's erudite. And the crowd was pretty into it. Older crowd. I mean, am I median age, or was I a little bit on the young side? I'm probably somewhere like that at almost 50.
Yeah, I saw him do it was a couple part series, I guess it was on the BBC original, about the history of aviation, mm-hmm. just how it started. I mean, he could be what they call a presenter over there. He's just got that, like, he's got the energy, he's got the voice and the delivery to hook you into these programs. But, and then he talked about his own history with flying planes, but I just thought it was interesting because it's something he's very passionate about.
Absolutely. Obviously, you know, he's flown every kind of plane all over the world, thousands and thousands of hours, owns and started and manages an aviation company while also becoming a fantastic fencer and leading Iron Maiden to huge heights and writing books of fiction and nonfiction and putting on being a brewmaster of some really good beer. I mean,
you posted a picture of that. Is that good stuff, the Trooper?
Yeah, I just had the IPA last night. I got a box that had, it was kind of a sample thing. And yeah. there's a porter in there, and there's a sake-based one because of the Senjutsu, you know, and a few different kinds in there. So I'm like, all right, I'm only going to have a few. I'm not going to drink the 12-pack. And I want to be on a steady course. I only had a few of the pale ales. But yes, they were very good. But some of those have some kick to them. I saw some 6.0 and 6.8 in there. So they're not mucking about the Maidens, their beer. And that's Bruce. I mean, he's a polymath. He's like, I'm going to take this seriously. And even with the brewery, he gets after it.
Excellent.
Please check out this word from our sponsors.
Oh, wait. We don't have any sponsors.
But I didn't realize that Shepherd's Bush Empire, which is where I was, the O2 there, was a place that the Who played at a lot. I don't know if that's where they used to hang out a lot, was Shepherd's Bush. But I guess it's an area or a spot that had supported them a lot over the years. And in doing research for Who's Next, because we had to do, as part of our leading up to our 50th show here, Jackson, do some 50th anniversary albums. And Who's Next, God, it's a huge record. I don't know, how big are the Who? The fact that we hadn't done a Who show out of like 50, it was kind of shocking to me. And it's like, okay, what's the big, if you got to do one Who record, what's it going to be? It's got to be Who's Next.
Correct. I was really never into the Who as growing up. I mean, I knew who they were. I listened to the tracks, but like there were people who were really, really into like Tommy mm-hmm. and then Quadrophenia. And I think if I remember correctly, long about like 87, 88, they did Tommy.
89.
Yeah, 89 they did. And it was huge. I remember that, like they had the hype for that. Was insane. They were going to do the whole thing, start to finish. So that's kind of when I really started to, you know, like, oh, you know, who are you? What's going on with these guys? There were people that I knew that were big fans of them. I never was. And in doing this research for the show, I was kind of thinking, well, why not? Why was I never into the Who? And I think it's because they're really not like anybody else. They're not like the Stones. They're not like the Beatles. Especially in this phase, like we've talked about before, we're into the big chunky guitar hooks. Mm-hmm. There really aren't any of those in this, especially on this record. It's kind of like everybody's working on this at the same time. There is no lead in with the hook that I'm used to.
I got you. Yeah, because I'm like, there's definitely some guitar riffs that you recognize universally on these things. But
correct.
You're right. It's not like that's the whole thing, like it is in a Jimmy Page kind of song. Right. Right. Yeah, you're right.
The easiest way to describe the Who, or the easiest way for me to think of the Who, is how the comedian Jay Mohr describes them. The Who is lead guitar, lead vocals, lead bass, and lead drums. And it's four dudes who are, I don't want to say they're not fighting, because it doesn't sound like, but they're like wrestling for control of these songs. And it's, yeah, four guys who can play at super high levels, and no one wants to be second-class citizen in this band. Everybody wants to be out in front.
Yeah, and I was going to say, to me, that's what makes them
more like Led Zeppelin than anyone else. Maybe not from texture of sound, but just to the fact that all four of them are so top-notch at what they do. And Pete doesn't have a lot of soaring solos the way Jimmy does.
Yeah, no.
None of that. But the way he puts the chords together, the way sometimes he plays the fiddly bits, as they say, yeah. But then also can riff it up, obviously, with some of the best of them doing a windmill here and there for a little show. And Moon's crazy. It's like he's a crazy kid. I mean, he was still awfully young at this point. I feel like Keith Moon at 71, in 1971, was still only like 23 years old at the most or something like that. You know, he started so young, or 22. He was so young when he started. But doing research for this, because for me, my experience with The Who was a lot of people, you would always hear Who on classic rock. A lot of people had this old Who's Greatest Hits that was a button-down Union Jack shirt was the cover, basically. Yeah. Remember that one? A lot of people had that.
Yeah, and again, I mean, that's back in the day when we've talked about this before. You kind of had to use your money wisely. So if they had a greatest hit, you were going to get that because you didn't want to wade through, I don't really like this track. I want the big stuff, bang for my buck.
That's right. You know, and this one had 13 singles. The other thing with The Who is they released a lot of non-album singles. They weren't a band who put out records and then, you know, released everything off of there as singles. Stuff like The Seeker was not on an album, and Joined Together was not on an album. And Magic Bus, I don't think that was really on an album, you know, or at least eventually maybe it came out, they added it to one or something. They had all these songs. So just having one record was tough because you were missing singles anyway. You mentioned Tommy and Quadrophenia. Well, those are double records. Mm-hmm. And although they both have like some classic Who hits on them, there's all sorts of other stuff in there, you know, to digest. Plus, if it's $30 back then, that's a lot of money for two discs, a lot of which is kind of just some of that operatic, I'd call it filler. But some of them
are. I was going to say the same thing, yeah, like almost like a bridge, one song to another. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Those aren't really like standalone songs that would ever be played on the radio, right? You have to kind of get through there to get to them. And so that was kind of the big greatest hits album for the longest time. And then, but it had My Wife on there from Who's Next, not to mention Won't Get Fooled Again, edited down, of course, because you can't just put an 8.5 minute song on there. But I just, doing research for this, I didn't realize that this was also the bones of this were supposed to be yet another rock opera or movie thing, you know, called Lifehouse, and something that Townsend continued to work on forever, for, you know, for like another 30 years, basically, which means they did Tommy, what was that, 69,
yeah,
the double album, you know, whatever. And then this is Who's Next in between, where they culled the best of them, said, all right, we're not going to do that crazy project. Glyn Johns is going to pull together the best songs, you know, from off of there. And then the next one they did in 73 was Quadrophenia, which is another double album rock opera from back in the day that was also eventually made into the movie. So it's like over those 5 or 6 years, it was basically three records, all of them kind of crazy out there, telling a huge story, incorporating a lot of different musicians and sounds, and a hell of a lot of music at once. And this is the one that didn't get finished for a long time. Eventually, Pete did a lot with it in the 90s, which we can get into. But just pulling out these eight tracks plus My Wife, which is one Entwistle wrote and sang and was done during the sessions, pull those eight out, and that's what we're going to make out of this record. And it's going to be the best record you ever had.
And I think that's really, in thinking about this band, how they were put together, it's not like anybody else. There is no Lennon McCartney. There is no Plant Page. There is no Jagger Richards. It's Pete Townsend. Like, yeah, you mentioned My Wife, written by Entwistle as an additional track, but he really wrote, he's the mastermind behind all of this, is Pete Townsend. And it's a weird dynamic because you've got this guy, you would just think that, oh, you know, Daltrey as the singer wrote all, no, he was just, I don't want to say along for the ride, but kind of along for the ride. And I really wonder if Townsend had a better rock and roll voice. He's got a great voice.
Right.
Not like Daltrey's.
That's for sure.
Would he have just kind of done the whole thing himself?
And that's interesting. And it's probably a confidence thing for a while. Like when he was younger, the big lanky kid with the big nose, I think hiding behind that guitar was a good thing,
yeah.
You know, and not singing that much. much. And then having the good looking front man out there like Roger Daltrey is another good thing for you, you know, because Daltrey really can sing and does justice to all Pete's tunes. Yeah, but it's a fair question. And obviously they share a little bit here on this one, right? It's not all Daltrey
right
on this one singing. Pete they slide back and forth a little bit, which is cool, which we always like. We like to hear different voices on a record. We talked about that on many shows in the past.
Right.
But no, it was the late 80s. You mentioned that. Yeah, the Who did that big tour. It was a big deal. I remember I had a classmate of mine who recorded.
Yeah, simulcast it.
Did they simulcast it on like the radio or the TV or something? And she had recorded it, and I asked her to make me a tape, and she did it. It was really beautiful. Like, she did different colors for every song and some different fonts. She was really smart and talented. She went to Harvard. She wasn't really my friend. I think she was just doing me a favor. It was like, oh, this poor little rock kid. Let me give him a souvenir while I go off to do great things. But also that time, the Who were wise of the fact that now CDs are pretty prevalent out here. Now we can put a lot of greatest hits on CD. So I got Who's Better, Who's Best around that time on CD, because it was like, all right, you got to buy classic stuff. CDs are so expensive. You got to buy the classic stuff. Who has this kind of new greatest hits album, which had more songs on it, including Bob O'Reilly, which was somehow not on the Union Jack greatest hits from back in the early 80s. And so I had those two things, right? I had all their great stuff on CD, and then I had these tapes for the car that was them doing Tommy and a lot of their classic stuff there. So then I was like pretty darn into Who, because like a lot of the bands you're starting to learn about and listen to, you're either never going to see again, either they're just done, they're dead, or they do get back together, it's going to be Small Time or something like that. But then because it was the Pink Floyd did it in 87 and 88, the Stones did Steel Wheels in 89 and 90, and the Who were back doing this. And so that kind of vaulted them up into the top five for me, probably at the time, in that time of high school. Like, who are the five greatest rock bands, or who are your five favorite? The Who were certainly in the top 10 and probably in the top five at that time.
Yeah. This is way back memories now that I'm trying to access here. I know I think they played at a giant stadium, which was enormous. And I think they may have even done more than one night. I mean, it was just in the New York area. It was
a big deal.
Huge.
Yeah.
They hyped it every single day. I think they had them in there to talk about it with all the, the legendary jocks from NEW. And yeah, it was in the summer. So it was like, you're going to have this huge outdoor deal, and the Who were back and to do this thing. Yeah, they were, you're right. That late 80s period was a big kind of resurgence for these guys from the 70s, the Stones, the Pink Floyd, the Who. Yeah, it was, and I just remember thinking, I'm like, I've never even heard Tommy, I've never even heard of this. I need to do some research like quick, or I'm going to get left out of the conversations around the old high school.
Because they did the tour in 82, the It's Hard tour, and they had the tragedy in Cincinnati where people got trampled and they died, and then they kind of did the show because nobody told them. And they did the show anyway, and then they broke up. Pete went off to be a solo artist, so did Roger, and we didn't know if we were ever going to get the Who again. And then they came back. Obviously, this was their big comeback. It was a really, really big deal in the classic rock scene. And of course, Pete's like, no, I have tinnitus and I can't really tour. And I don't know, he's continued to tour a lot ever since, which is good because I've seen him a few times, which we'll get into. But just learning about this record, it's fascinating. They used the Rolling Stones mobile recording studio to make this record, which we talked about on our last episode. Or no, I'm sorry, it'd be episode 46 on Led Zeppelin 4. It's like, how big time is the Rolling Stones mobile studio?
You say that, and I was thinking the same thing when I was reading this. We ought to do something, a show on that. I mean, whoever thought of this idea, what we need? We need a studio, top-notch, that you can move around. Obviously, it was a big hit because all these big-time people were like, no, I want it. It's like they were in line. I want it next. Just a fantastic idea. I really wonder who had the genesis of that. Like, we could put all of this in a truck or whatever it was and then move it wherever you want to record. It's some house out in the middle of nowhere, like Led Zeppelin did, but we can have this professional recording studio for you.
Is that Mick Jagger? I mean, it's the Rolling Stones. Was it Mick Jagger? Was it his idea? Did he come up with it?
Yeah, I don't know, but obviously it was a home run.
All right, well, so, yeah, because here are a few of the albums that were recorded in that mobile studio. Zeppelin 3 and Zeppelin 4, Houses of the Holy, and part of Physical Graffiti, were all recorded in that Exile on Main Street and Sticky Fingers. Who's Next is obviously Deep Purple used it for Burn. Bad Company used it for Running with the Pack. Iron Maiden used it on the Live After Death tour, which wow. We did a show on, what was that number? Show number 14 was on Live After Death. Alchemy Dire Straits Live. That's one of our very most popular shows. Show number 12. So please go check that out. So yeah, I mean, you know, live Bob Marley and the Wailers. What an amazing little piece of equipment. That ought to be in a museum somewhere, is it? I don't know.
Yeah. You're right. It should be. And like I said, obviously it was something that hadn't happened before, hadn't been in existence before, but once it was, everybody collectively said, this is a great thing, we all need to use it. Yeah, if the walls could talk.
I know. So, all right, but so, you know, they also work at Olympic Sound Studios with Glyn Johns. Kind of working as an engineer, got the associate producer's credit, but he really did, was kind of a producer on it. Obviously, he was pretty exacting and worked them through their paces. That's kind of his reputation. But he also let them be really loud. And maybe only had one mic on Keith Moon because he beat the snot out of all those drums. Whereas, you know, when he recorded Don Henley, he's like, can I have some more mics on my drums? Like, no, hit it harder. You know? Take that, Henley, as Glyn Johns for you. So, all right, yeah. So they've kind of started whittled down. But you have to feel, I mean, versus Tommy, versus most hard rock songs and Who songs, they use a lot of synth and keyboard in these things. Sometimes they're kind of just in the background. And I know Pete basically played and recorded and tracked most all of those. But it obviously changes the sound a little bit. I mean, I think that's got a lot to do with why this thing is so classic, because it did change things at the time. And it still sounds different, yet mixes in with sounds that we've become more accustomed to over the years. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the more that you listen to it, you can hear the other stuff going on in the background when you really concentrate. There is a lot of stuff going on here. I know that the Lifehouse project, it was supposed to be like some kind of it was another opera deal, but some of it was going to be like interactive with the studio audience or the live audience. Yeah. They were going to contribute to the set. It was never going to happen at that point in time, but it was like next level thinking, three-dimensionally
right out.
It was just ahead of its time, I think, and no one. So I think that's where it came from. A lot of the electronic stuff
mm-hmm.
that ended up on the record came out of that, trying to push the envelope with the recording.
Well, it obviously worked. I mean, Baba O'Reilly, the process, it's called a Lowry organ that Townsend, you know, programmed basically to play it like that, which is because I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't sound like a human's doing that, right? But it's brilliant because once you can create it and it's supposed to sound like that, it's not supposed to be a human being playing it, it's supposed to be a machine programmed to do that, then it's going to be perfect every time. And it's going to be right on the right beat, on the right sound every single time. So, like, that's an easy way to start the tune, right?
Wait, I thought it was called Teenage Wasteland.
Well, yes, that was the working title for a while, wasn't it?
That used to drive me up the wall. I mean, I'm not the biggest Who fan on the face of the earth, but when somebody would say that to me, I would just say, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you anymore. We have to move on. That's not the name of the song. Figure it out. But I do kind of like that it has kind of that, and I like it with Led Zeppelin too, where it's not called Teenage Wasteland. Yes, they say it
right
in the song, but it's, oh, wait, what? What does the title of the song mean then? Well, do a little research and figure it out, because okay, it's not straight in your face.
So, but straight in your face, it was Townsend playing homage to guru Meher Baba and minimalist composer Terry Riley. And it was released as Teenage Wasteland when they did some re-releases and had demos and things like that. The working demo was called Teenage Wasteland. So you can get that up in the various versions that have been re-released over the years. Also, just kind of interested to know that a lot of stuff that ended up going onto records for years came out of Lifehouse. I mean, stuff that would end up going on Who Are You and It's Hard. I mean, stuff that they continue to do singles down the road, like Join Together with the Band, that were just standalone singles. Slip Kid, Relay, all these things came out of those sessions. Stuff that just ended up on all of their records until they finally called it quits.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an amazing time for Pete Townsend, right?
Which I think is cool that he didn't just scrap it and say, well, this is not going to work, and start it over again, because we did get some great tracks out of this. And so I'm glad that, yeah, he didn't just junk the whole project.
I think Who Are You, which is obviously a huge hit, you know, in the 70s, right before Keith Moon dies, I think. Yeah, Who Are You? He had that laying around. And that's eventually going to be the album title of the big single, you know, 7 years later, whenever that was. So just incredible to me, the talent there. Hey out there, rock and rollers. It's the Wolf stateside here with the Wolf Cub and the Bulldogs. Give them a shout. But yeah, start off with Baba O'Reilly. Like that's what just going to kick it off like that, this huge rock classic. And they trade, right? Roger does a little bit and Pete does a little bit of the bridge.
Yeah, that's a great trade-off because Townsend is kind of singing the softer, easier, not easier to sing, but like just more quiet part of the song. And then Daltrey comes back in and kicks you in the face with the big, not really operatic, but kind of the bigger part. So it's a great trade-off within the song.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Having those two textures in the song vocally to deliver those different lyrics. Yeah, absolutely.
Keith Moon, he's playing the drums, quote unquote, but not really. Like, not like we're used to. He's not setting the beat. He's going insane. Again, he's wrestling for control of the song. Like, if you ever...
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
I'm sure you, as everyone else with children, have watched The Muppet Show.
Yeah.
Right? The drummer, is an ode to Keith Moon. That's what he's doing back there. Like you said, he only needs one mic because you just need to stand back because you're probably going to get hurt if you stand too close to the drum kit.
That's right.
Yeah. And I don't know, I'm sure there's a style. I'm not a drummer. I don't know. Maybe somebody can comment on this later on, but the way that he's playing, it's a separate piece. It's almost like it's a lead drum part to the song.
And it all
the fills
somehow
that he's using.
Squishes together.
Yes. Yeah. And that comes with everybody else is so great that you can fit it together and make something workable come out of it, even though it's not a traditional way to play.
That's for sure. I mean, just the way he held the sticks was odd.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, he was obviously, my guess is today he would have been diagnosed ADHD, as so many drummers are. But at least he had this incredible outlet for all that. Because it's really, this work, I mean, all his work in The Who was fantastic. But this album, everyone coming together so well. And I was just going to say, you like them trading vocals a little bit, making Baba O'Reilly. They did the same thing in Bargain right afterward.
Yeah.
When it slows down and one and one don't make two, one and one make one. That's great, yeah. Pete Townsend right there. Whereas when Daltrey's singing about, you know, I lose myself just to find you, I'd throw anything away just to get to you, that'd be a bargain.
Yeah.
He's singing that part, you know, and I've seen them three times. The second time I saw them, which was about 5 years ago or so, with my buddy Tom in Louisville, he introduced it as, when he wrote it, Pete did, that this is one he was really proud of. Like he wrote this as like, you know what, I've really done something good here. I've done something special here. And then being able to go out and sing that part on there was him kind of stepping out a little bit to do a little bit more singing in a sensitive spot there, kind of bearing your soul a little bit. But he's like, this is so good. Yeah, I'm proud of it. I'm going to do it. And I thought, see, that little tidbits you get to see, you don't just get to see him live. You get a little something like that. That's worth every penny.
Yeah, this could be one of my favorite Who songs that they've ever done. And it's got that real slow start to it. Then that's like the roller coaster going up again. And then you go over the hit when the drums come in and Daltrey, that, you know, that the chord comes in and then he comes in with the vocals. Yeah, this is a great song. And the back and forth, it's powerful. And then it slows down and then boom again. Yeah, I love this song. And in reading more about it, like, is it about like finding the love of another person, or is it finding the love of God? Because he was in the whole, you know, guru phase. Mm-hmm. You know, when you kind of start to think about that, you're like, all right, we're getting a little heavy duty here in this song.
A little, you could say, yeah. I mean, that's the thing about Pete. You know, he was so smart for a rock and roll writer. He could really kind of put things together, take a lot from different things, but say it succinctly. And with a big ringing guitar, I think Pete Townsend is special in the world of rock and roll.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he is underappreciated because I think the Who does get lumped in, not lumped in, but they get kind of put in the same category as the Stones and the Beatles, and they're like another animal, like another category. You have to have another category for the Who. They don't fit into the normal rock and roll band dynamic.
Well, yeah, I mean, and they're special, that's for sure. Then, okay, so Bargain, big bombast, lots of big Keith Moon drone there. Then you go to Love Ain't for Keeping. It's an acoustic one, right? A little slower. It's short. It's a little more than 2 minutes, whereas the last couple were five plus minutes.
Yeah.
So it is a transition song, right? It's a pump the brakes kind of thing, as you like to say.
Yeah, real nice change of pace. Yeah, you couldn't take it. I don't think you could take another one after those first two. So yeah, it sounds like a little country-esque, you know, kind of lighter, you know, just a palate cleanser there. And Loving, come on over here and talk to me here. Love's not for keeping. I've got some work to do over here.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you can't, you know, you couldn't just follow that up with Won't Get Fooled Again. It's like, okay, now you've blown your wad and nobody's going to listen to the whole rest of the record.
Right.
It's like, with those three, it's like there's nothing else to hear. I mean, you know, you just blew up my head. But no, right. Nice, easygoing song. I like it. And then into the Entwistle classic, My Wife, written and sung by The Ox, John Entwistle.
Right. And when you listen to this song, it's a kind of an over-the-top caricature, but you can say, yeah, in one way or another, I've been there before, John. I understand what it's like to make the old lady upset with you and have her want to do horrible things to you when you get home because you stayed out too late or maybe missed an appointment or I don't know what. But yeah, it's just a funny kind of tongue-in-cheek, oh, she's mad. The old lady's mad at me again.
Right. Yeah, perfect for The Ox, too. And I guess this was going to maybe be on his solo album, but they recognize this one's pretty good. And look, he didn't just sing and play the bass. He played the piano and he did the horns. He did the brass in the song.
That's really cool. A nice part of the song that you don't really hear a whole lot. Yeah, the brass was cool.
And, you know, they all, well, I mean, look, Keith basically plays the drums. Roger basically sings. But John can do other things, and he's done brass and different horns on different stuff over the years. Pete does the guitar and the organ and the synths, a little piano here and there. Obviously does some singing lead too. So it's a talented band. I think that Pete is the special writer and probably good instrumentalist, the best instrumentalist. However, you know, he was telling a story that I was watching that, you know, they'd be jamming along sometimes, and Pete's like, I'll get John Entwistle, I'll show him. He'll go, be-li-di-li-di-li-di-li-di. And then John would just hear it and go follow. And he was like, whoa. And he's like, it wouldn't have worked if it had gone the other way, right? It's like, I couldn't have done it back to him if he'd just done something crazy with the bass. So it's like, yeah, John Entwistle is an incredibly special bass player, and you can hear it throughout a lot of Who songs over the years, but we're going to get into a couple here that it's just really killer. And I think he had a good groove on this one for his song, but there's a couple we'll get to that I think he really stands out on.
Alrighty. And I think that just proves the whole point before about how this would not have worked without these four guys, this whole idea. Because yeah, if you had somebody who was just thump, thump, thumping along on the bass, it wouldn't have worked. He's got to really, since the drums are not going to do that part, he's really got to set the groove. Mm-hmm. But then he gets to kind of walk around underneath and do things. It's not just straight ahead.
And it's cool. And if you can single it out, and again, it took me a while to get to be old enough that I could really just follow the bass, appreciate it in songs, but if you can single out John's bass, it's different, it's special, it's cool.
It's almost like it's its own piece of music added on to the rest of the song. He's not just following along, he's doing his own thing, but it all works.
Song is over, is it's nice. Again, this is Pete and Roger kind of sharing vocal duties here.
But now we flip the script because now Townsend's singing the verses.
Right. And there's great piano and synth on this song, which I guess Pete kind of laid down in there as well. And some of it's kind of behind, but it's very electronic. You can hear it, but it's not overwhelming. That's why it's not like new wave stuff that we would see 10 years after this. It's a beautiful song. It's very nice, and it's good for Pete to be able to step out here, do the lead, and then Roger's doing the other part, which is, it's almost, yeah, it's the chorus because it does repeat, but it's almost like it's the verse because it's Roger singing.
Yeah. But just the way that he delivers it, it works better for Townsend's voice to be the first one that you hear on it, because he's got that softer, he can softer that high, soft part that he puts in it fits in better, and then Daltrey can come in and add to it.
That's right. And, you know, this is one that they'll play on the radio. Look, so far, all five songs so far are things that we have heard on rock radio growing up. My wife, maybe not quite so much. But like I said, it was on that Greatest Hits with the Union Jack shirt on it that right. was kind of popular in my neck of the woods back in the day. So it was in the air. So all these things are things that they play and were some kind of radio hit at some point. But the one that really wasn't out of the nine on the record was Getting In Tune, the next song. However, and this is the one, Jackson, there's always one that I either don't remember or can't remember the name, or, you know, one's just out of all of these, one escapes me. And it's this one just because I haven't heard it on the radio ever, to the best of my knowledge. And all the others I have.
I would agree with you. Yeah, I mean, when you go through all of these, this could be a greatest hits record. But yeah, unfortunately, this one gets, I mean, it's the, again, you've already been through back in the old days, the record. This is side one is over. Now we're getting into side two. You know, you've already kind of come through the ride. So unfortunately, this one does get a little lost. But yeah, it's a great, this is what you were talking about with the bass groove.
The legendary bass of Entwistle on this is fantastic. Yeah. You know, he's got some good piano in it, which I guess Pete is playing. I know Nicky Hopkins was around at some sessions, but I mean, I think that Pete really played all the stuff that got recorded. But, you know, it's a little bit easy, you know, kind of slow. And then it gets a little harder in some points. There's some call and repeat in there. But it's light. It's got some nice harmony. And, yeah, you finish with the flurry jam, where, like you say, all four of them are just doing their own thing. And to me, that's where Entwistle is standing out from all of them.
Yeah. And yeah, you can hear that. I mean, what do they call them? Thunder fingers. You can hear them just boom, 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 boom. That's if you isolated the track and just played it, you'd say that's John Entwistle. He's got a very distinctive way of just, I mean, again, we were talking about Moon beating the crap out of these drums. He's really beating this bass too. Just digging in there and pulling some tasty grooves out of it.
Yeah. He has a style that's very hard to imitate. It's like he's got at least three, if not all four, of his right-hand fingers. It almost looks like they're all doing something different, and they are sometimes, but they're all doing it in unison. He's never looking at it.
Yeah.
I've never seen anyone play like him.
I think too, if I remember correctly, like he'll strike the strings with the bottom, like the pads, but I think he'll also do the top, like with the nails, like back and forth, and that's what gets that really, yeah, I've never seen him use a pick. It's always just, and I think it sits up kind of high too, so he can get all over the neck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just a great add-on to everybody else. Like, yeah, everybody else, great. And then we're going to throw in John Entwistle to do the bass. Can't miss.
And I did see them play with John Entwistle once. The three times I saw him, McKee and I went down to see them play in the Ice Palace in Tampa.
Okay.
But they were doing Quadrophenia in its entirety, and I didn't know that. I just saw the Who are coming. Oh, my God. I got to get – where are they coming? What's the closest place? Because I think I was living in Gainesville for school, or I was living in Jacksonville, but like between semesters. So I went down to Orlando, got him, and then we went to the Ice Palace. And then when I got there, they were playing Quadrophenia in its entirety. I didn't really know all of Quadrophenia at that point. You know, eventually I got it, and I know it a lot better now. But I didn't know they were playing that. And, you know, and again, it's a lot like Tommy in that there's some filler in there. And some just kind of are trying to tell a story. They're not amazing songs, but they're moving the story along. And then at the end, they came in and did a greatest hits. And Pete told us all to shut the fuck up because he was tinnitus and his ears were ringing. And he had put down the electric guitar. He had an acoustic guitar out. And he's like, that's, you know, just shut the fuck up because I can't hear. But he came out and did Won't Get Fooled Again, you know, with the acoustic, did Behind Blue Eyes, Substitute, I Can't Explain, and Who Are You to wrap it up after doing all of Quadrophenia, which includes some hits like 515 and, of course, Love Rain Over Me. But
did, just out of curiosity, who's playing drums that night? Starkey?
If it wasn't Zach Starkey, it was Simon Phillips, who I think had been with them for a while.
My favorite story about Zach Starkey, obviously Zach Starkey is Richard Starkey's son. You even know better as Ringo Starr. He was given his first set of drums by his Uncle Keith, who was Keith Moon. So to have him then go on to play with The Who years later is pretty cool. And obviously he's a fantastic drummer if he can handle those parts.
Yeah, no doubt. He's the real thing. He's awesome. Yeah. It was Zach.
Ah, okay.
Simon Phillips did, it looks like, helped out on that, on the Tommy thing. But yeah, Zach has been in the band since 97, and they haven't had another drummer. So yeah, that's right. I guess I've seen Zach 3 times and didn't really realize it. So thanks for making me go out and research that, get that done there, Jackson. Because yes, I did see Zach Starkey play the drums, yes, in 1997. How about that? All right, so where are we back to? Back to now returning you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Correct. Now we're going to get to the song Going Mobile, which apparently in the UK, and I don't know if you probably haven't experienced this yet, apparently this is a very polarizing subject because it's about the getting a caravanning, as they call it. Buying a caravan, going, either you love caravanning or you hate the people who caravan. Apparently that's the way it goes because you're trying to get somewhere and there's 9,000 of these things driving at 40 miles an hour down the highway. But it's a cool tune. I guess Daltrey was not even associated in any way with this track. It was just the three of them. It's a cool Townsend song. He sings it all by himself. You know, it's kind of light. And yeah, it's about getting out there and keep me moving. Get out on the highway. I can do whatever I want, but make the tea and toast on the road, meet different people. It, just a kind of a light, nice change of pace.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Yeah, it's light. It's a good Pete song. It's pretty upbeat. It does slow down for middle eight in there for middle. But I like the part where it goes beep, beep. And it's just a happy little song.
Yeah.
You know, they've been playing on for years. They watch the police and the tax man miss me. I'm mobile. I'll just go to America, tax man. See you later. Because this was the era of you had to move away, right? This is when the Stones became Tex Exiles. Someone told me once in England, at that point, if you made over £1 million, if you were in the upperest tax bracket, you paid 103% income tax. So if you made £1 million, you owed them £1,030,000. And that's what Bill Wyman's like, we couldn't make it. We couldn't make enough to pay the tax bill. You know, so we left. We had to. Like, oh, now you're bad boys. You're just lining your pockets in France. Like, well, geez, man, you got to let me keep some of the money. You know, in America, I think in the 60s for a while, the highest tax bracket was 90% or something sick like that, and eventually it got resolved to something a little more manageable. All I know is that 90%, 103% is too high.
The only thing I'll say about that is when people do talk about tax rates and stuff and how we should increase the tax rates for certain people, well, that's all I think about is you can do whatever you want, but if you do, they're just going to leave. That's what they did. You know, all of those guys, like you said, every band that we love and follow, yeah, they just said, okay, that's not acceptable for me. Goodbye. And took off. And so now you got nothing. Way to go.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is interesting because we talk about going to different places that kind of spurred people to move other places and have new experiences because they were not happy with what was going on in the UK.
Yeah. And you know, they've got the mobile recording studio and they're like, hey, we don't have to be there. We go someplace else. Right. So let's split.
South of France is real nice.
Yeah. You know, go to America, take it, whatever. Easy enough. So yeah, but great tune, happy little tune. Cause you know, it could be that whole, because Taxman by George Harrison, it's kind of a negative song, you know, whereas this one, like, yeah, not going to get me. I'm out of here. I'm doing my thing. You're not stopping me. Yeah. So that's fun. And then next, Behind Blue Eyes, man, this is a great dichotomy of the Who, right? It's slow. It's sad. It's remorseful. Maybe looking back at your life, being regretful, even at least that's got that tone. And then you, when my fist clenches, crack it open, you're ready to fight. Put some heftiness in there to it. Daltrey delivers it all very well.
Yeah. And it's, you're right. It is. It kind of starts off slow with the acoustic guitar and then it comes in hard and heavy. And I was reading something about how Moon is not on the first part of this track. He comes in the second part and they said that's the longest he ever sat still in his whole life.
Yeah.
So yeah, just yeah.
A minute and a half, two minutes, whatever.
Oh, come on, let me play. Yeah, it's a great song. I mean, just a rock radio staple forever. This is on multiple times a day.
All the time.
And I think this was one of the, had something to do with the bad guy in the Lifehouse timeline,
mm-hmm.
the Lifehouse story. Yeah. So it was something that they took and kind of made fit into this record. But yeah, definitely this was one of the concept songs.
Right. Yes. No one was like to be the bad man. Yeah. We all are who we are. This is another one where I think Ox just in the background doing his thing up and down.
Yeah.
delivering on that bass, man. Just and I think it's got a sweetness to it that the girls liked it. I remember in high school, the girls would sing along a little bit to this one. It's not exactly a ballad, but it's definitely got that hard crunch in the middle of it. But it does, it's reprise almost to the end. It's where it goes soft and beautiful again.
Yeah, and I think it resonates with a lot, especially younger people, when you're, you know, you've got this, like, you're all mad at the world when you're, whatever, 18 or 19, but, you know, you kind of have to hide it behind a smile sometimes when you just, you know, because you think you know everything, and it, yeah, okay, yeah, it's great. Mm-hmm. So, but you're right, I did know a lot of girls who were really into this song. It really struck them. I think it's the kind of the soft, sweet part in the middle, or it sounds sweet. If you really listen, it's not so much, but right, if you're just kind of floating on top, it resonates.
It's nice. Yeah, it's pretty. Absolutely. And then, okay, well, we gotta close out the album with something. You just you wanna write, you know, some throwaway track and throw in there?
Sure.
Yeah, let's do that. Or don't, you know what we could do is create a world-changing 8-minute call to arms, bombastic track, one of the greatest rock and roll songs ever delivered, and we'll just kind of squeeze it on the back end here to round it all off. Are you kidding me?
If you had only heard the song and never had it in context, there's no way you would say that's the last song on an album. There's right. No freaking way. Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, one of probably their most famous songs played in the rock catalog. Yeah, it's just a great way to end the record. And yeah, 8 minutes and 32 seconds. It does not feel like that either.
Well, no, and the fact of the matter is they did have a single edit, which was less than 4 minutes, if I'm not mistaken, which we would hear on the radio sometimes, which makes sense. You maybe take out the middle bit that has all the cool keyboards and organs in it. Obviously, I don't think that's necessary these days, especially when so much radio is satellite anyway, and you know, terrestrial radio, they need a break to run to the bathroom or go have a smoke or something, right? So it's an extraordinary composition, and it has led to some iconic photos and videos of them playing this song with Pete doing windmills or yeah, sliding behind him when he gives out that kind of barbaric yawp at the... Yeah! When he really gets out there for it and he slid across the stage, Pete did. It's like, that is rock and roll. Rock and roll at its most theatric, at its purest, at its most bombastic. Just screaming out, yeah! And the whole place goes nuts, man. It's crazy.
And I like that. I like the middle keyboard part where it's kind of, you know, you're waiting for Moon. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And then, boom, 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 boom. Yeah, you know it's coming. It's fantastic. And the scream is, you know, everybody thinks they can scream like that when you're, you know, in the crowd. You're not, but you're trying, but it's cool.
No,
and just the themes, just, you know, the themes of having this revolution and changing things and, oh, wait a minute, meet the new boss. It's the same as the old boss.
That's right. Yeah, the changes have to happen over a long time. Right after revolution, it's probably not going to be all that different, is it? Right.
Right.
But no, the synth and all that build up in the middle where Keith does come back in and it builds like that up to the big scream. And then, yeah, at the end, when they do meet the new boss, same as the old boss, you just jamming on the guitar. Great place to end with some windmills there. Fantastic.
Yeah, this is probably, and I wrote this down, this is probably the best guitar track going back to the What We Love on the whole record. This is him. This is Pete being the guitar hero on this song.
Yeah, and it's got to be one of the best rock and roll songs ever written for the lyrics, for the delivery of it, and the bass. You listen to the bass in the background on this. Oh my goodness, it's crazy. It almost sounds like he's on a fretless bass at some point. I don't think that he is, but because he is using this unique aux technique, just killing it back there. Moon doing his thing. It's wow. It's amazing.
It's almost like organized chaos. There's so much going on, but they pull it together. Everybody is shining on this thing. Again, it goes back to the testament of these guys being extremely proficient on their instruments and being able to play different things, but all making it come together is phenomenal. And this is probably, like you were talking about before, this is probably the best track you could ever hear live. Just because you just get into it. And yeah, it's a very communal experience, I think, too, with the song and the themes, too.
Yeah, and when he screams, yeah, and they turn the lights on the whole house, and everyone's got their hands up screaming, yeah. that special.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, and that's why I think a lot of people see it as one of the very best rock records ever made, because you start with Bubba O'Reilly and you finish with Won't Get Fooled Again, and you have all these other different textures and great songs in the middle of it. But it's not the Tommy Story where you have to kind of sit through the filler and the other things. Although in the movie, it's great because maybe Ann Margaret's singing it. And I dig Ann Margaret. I always have, you know.
Okie dokie.
By the way, do you remember my old fraternity brother, Chris Fitzgerald? They called him Fitz. He was kind of short. He was an actor, and he was in the drama and the theater company and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Well, Fitz went on to become a fairly successful actor. Like, he's been nominated for a Tony and has won Drama Desk Awards and played Kristen Wiig's brother in a movie. And he was in this incredibly scary and not family-friendly show called Happy with Chris Maloney.
That's exactly what I was thinking of. And I'm like, I think I know that dude.
Yeah.
Or I remember him. And I looked up. That is straight up disturbing.
It is the strangest, most disturbing show I've ever seen in my life, bar none. I think it was on the Sci-Fi Channel. My, and Chris Maloney's a great actor. I'm like, God, this is bizarro land, and it's evil, and I don't want my family to even know I'm watching this stuff, you know?
Like if I had, when I was watching that show, if I'd have seen Fitz on the street, I would have crossed the street to the other side. That's how disturbing he was in that.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know him. I mean, I maybe met him once or twice. Seemed like a great guy, but yeah, he really got into that character, and that was it's one of those shows where you just thought, I don't even understand how this got made, because it's so bizarre.
It's so odd, I know. And I'm like, geez, Fitz, you know, way to make some real friendly family fair, you know, like my daughter's like watching Scooby-Doo, and like I'm trying to watch this because I want to follow him. And he's done some Ms. Maisels, you know, he's a working actor. He does really well. I think he's fantastic on the stage. Yeah, but Ann Margaret plays his wife in that.
Yes. Right.
As twisted as the whole show was and everything, I'm like, if I found out one day I was going to get to work with Ann Margaret, she's going to play my wife, even as odd as that would be with the age thing and all, I'm like, that's amazing. I'm like, hats off to Fitz, man. He followed his dream, man, and he's making it work. So good for him.
Well, we're following our dream right now.
Well, that's what I was about to say, yeah. So we finally have a radio show that dozens of people around the world seem to enjoy, or at least click on and download accidentally sometimes.
We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
The Who are huge. And then I was supposed to go see them again last year, Jackson. And it was right kind of in the wake of all the shutdowns. And then they were going to postpone it a year till this year. It was April of this year. And then they said, you know what, we're just not going to do it. They didn't. Most other people have rescheduled. Even if they had to reschedule 2-3 times, they've pushed it out far enough so that, all right, we get to 2022, we'll probably be safe. And obviously now that we're in the fall, I've been to a couple of shows that have taken place in venues like last night, seeing Bruce. And so it looks like the 2022 shows will probably happen, but The Who just decided to shut it down. I think Roger's doing a tour, like a solo tour coming up. But he's like, no, we're not going to honor those dates. You know, not that we're never going to play again. It's just we're not going to honor those dates. We take the insurance and go.
No, that's too bad. But yeah, it's tough now because it's almost like you had that real hard stop. You know, you're rolling and then, you know, you take a year, 2 years that have just kind of been thrown out. And like you were talking about before, with Bruce being the youngest guy that
Dave Grohl's probably younger, but as far as who we grew up with, yeah, he's one of the younger guys.
Yeah, but, you know, for the Who guys, you know, you're getting up in age, you know, you can't just jump right back into this. You've got to kind of warm yourself up. So, yeah, I think maybe they need to take some time to recenter themselves and decide what they want to do next.
Yeah, but for Daltrey, I mean, his voice, he can't stop using it. If he stops for too long, he's not going to get it back. So I think that's part of why he's going to go out and do a solo tour, because, you know, I can't just not do it for that long by the time The Who are ready to do one or two more shows, whenever it is. He can't just leave it on the shelf for that long.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, when I saw him in 96, like going to see The Who was a big deal. And when I saw him in 96, it was Entwistle still alive. They did all of Quadrophenia. And they're not that old then. You know, they're maybe not quite 50, or they're just in their early 50s. Then when I saw them 5 years ago, obviously they're in their 60s. They're getting pretty up there. This could be the last tour. That show had been postponed because Roger had been sick, or he got injured or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. They had to postpone a bunch of the tour. It wasn't just my date. It was a bunch of stuff that they postponed to a later date. So then when they saw them, when they came around, I was like, okay, I gotta make sure I go. I took my buddy Tom. And you know, they had a great set that night. And they played You Better You Bet, which I loved singing with my daughter at the time. She's about two. So that was fun, you know, that they did that. It was funny. Roger still plays the same old, like, vanilla Telecaster that he played on the Eminence Front video. He has the same one for when they sing Eminence Front, because that's a Pete song and he helps out a little bit in the chorus. So when they're setting everything up and they're tuning the guitar, I'm like, hey, Tom, that's the Eminence Front guitar. Daltrey's going to play that for Eminence Front. And then sure enough, that's exactly what happened. They came and brought it to him. Like, yep, I knew it. It's the same exact guitar, man. It's so funny. And then I was fortunate enough to see them in Wembley the summer we got here, which is a little more than 2 years ago. It was July 6, 2019 in Wembley. They did the first part, most of it, with an orchestra behind them. And Eddie Vedder had opened for them. And the Kaiser Chiefs had opened. And Eddie came out and sang with them at some point. It was really cool. I took my daughter, who had just turned 5. And God bless her, she made it. She took a nap during the day. We took her out. She was applauding at every song like it was the most amazing thing. She's like, oh, thank you, just clapping away, you know. And it was threatening rain all day, threatening. It never rained. And then the second to last song they played was Love Rain Over Me, and it started to rain. I swear to God, it was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. I'm sitting here, it's like, this is a sign. I don't know what this is, because you worry about taking your kid to a rock show, and I'd already taken her to Kiss, and I'm like, I knew I was kind of pushing my luck a little bit there. I'm like, we leave early at Kiss, it's fine, I know how it ends, but I really wanted to see the Who at Wembley, and she basically made it the whole way. I'm like, wow, she made it all the way to Love Rain Over Me. I'm like, okay, it's raining, we can walk out and listen to this song. And then do they rap with Don't Get Fooled, Won't Get Fooled Again? I think so. Oh, they rap with Bob O'Reilly, right. So,
okay.
Heard that on the way out. Great. They still delivered live. And look, they've got people like Pino Palladino playing bass for them now. They've got Zach Starkey. They've got all sorts of great people to kind of help thicken it up. And, of course, at Wembley that night, it was with an orchestra, which really made some stuff sound robust and fun. They stripped down for a few songs. But I was supposed to see them again at Wembley Arena, which is right next door. So, okay, a little more intimate this time. Maybe a 20,000 people in there or something like that. And they postponed it, and then they said, nah. So who knows if they'll reschedule again, but I see people like Foo Fighters and Coldplay and festivals and stuff all lining up for 2022. So, and yep, we're doing some smaller shows now. So, and Genesis got through almost all of their tour before somebody got COVID. And I was supposed to see them last week, and that has been postponed indefinitely now. They've got a U.S. tour to do starting in November, in mid-November, I think. So my guess is they're not going to try to, first of all, the O2, they were doing 3 dates at the O2. Where are you going to get 3 spare dates laying around at the O2? That just doesn't happen. You got to go way out in the future for that. I think they're going to just, like, let's get everybody healthy, chill out. We'll go to America, try to get that done. And then sometime, in 2022, when we can get the dates back, we'll do it. Because they got to want to do, they had 4 dates left, including 3 in London. Like, you got to want to play London to wrap this up. This is the last tour. And it was going down well. I was like, you got to go back to London. You got to finish those shows. They owe me, God damn it.
You're right. That's probably what will happen. They'll probably come here, do what they need to do, and then come back and try and reschedule. Because you're right, you can't leave those on the table. I mean, no offense, but if it was somewhere out in the sticks, maybe we can, you know, oh, sorry, can't make it. But yeah, to not end in London, no. And you're right. I can't imagine there's going to be another tour after this. I just can't.
No way.
This is going to be it.
Well, that wraps up episode number 48 of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock podcast, folks. I hope you enjoyed my take on seeing Bruce Dickinson live at Shepherd's Bush Empire and our review of the Who's Next, one of the true classic albums in all of rock history, celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And for those of you who are worried about our talk on Genesis, well, they have officially rescheduled. It's March 24th, 25th, and 26th at the O2 in London in 2022. They're going to do some touring in Europe, mostly in Germany, a little bit in Paris, and a couple of other spots ahead of coming back to London to wrap that up in late March next year. And I really can't wait to see that. Really hope it goes down. It's been rescheduled several times at this point, and we just hope everybody's healthy and able to perform that show. But yes, seeing The Who live was really special for me. The several times that I got to do it, really glad I got to take my daughter to see them. They're truly one of the greatest rock bands to ever walk the face of the earth. Their songs are incredible. They're classics. Pete Townshend may be the greatest poet
in the history of rock and roll. Sorry, Bob Dylan. Sorry, Lennon and McCartney. Someone who can really speak to the people, put a lot of different complex ideas together in simple phrasing with incredible guitar riffs that make a lot of sense. And hopefully we'll get to see The Who again. Who knows? Maybe that should be the name of their new album. Who knows? Their last album was really awesome, I thought. And I really was hoping to see it live. So maybe we'll get that opportunity one day. At any rate, folks, as we always ask at the end of every show, do we get something right? Did we get something wrong? Do we miss the point? Did we leave out your favorite part? You have to let us know. Check us out on Twitter, @ugly_werewolf or @actionjack72, and you can tweet us or DM us. Let us know which albums or bands you would like us to review here on the show. Of course, you can check out all past episodes at www.uglyamericanwerewolf.libsyn.com, and you can subscribe and download anywhere you get your podcast, be it Google, Amazon, Apple, Spotify. And what would really help us out is if you could give us a great review if you're enjoying the show, whether it's on Apple or Podchaser or Good Pods or anywhere that you like to get your podcast. Let people know. It helps us find other listeners like you. The more reviews we get, the easier it is for us to get interviews and invest in the show to make it better for all of you. Now, next week, we are continuing to march toward our 50th show with another album celebrating its 50th year this year, and that's The Doors' L.A. Woman, which turned out to be Jim Morrison's last ever with the band and really last album that he ever did. Some incredible tunes on there that have stood the test of time, and we can't wait to talk to you about that one. So until next week, all you rock and rollers all around the world, be cool and stay safe.
percent of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
With one of the best savings rates in America, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than choosing Slash to be in your band.
Next up for lead guitar. You're in.
Cool. Yep, even easier than that. And with no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.